You know, we have a major problem here in America, a problem with the way we police. That's what my next guest says, and he certainly knows. He's the retired Seattle police chief. Norm Stamper is with us. His brand new book is To Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police. Norm, great to have you on WILS.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
When you, as a police chief in Seattle, what were the major problems you had within your department, would you say, then?
Well, I think they would apply to every major city and most smaller cities in the country, and that is a tendency on the part of that institution to create policies and procedures and practices that sort of ignore the fact that the police in this country belong to the people and not the other way around.
But with the dynamic of knowing your officers are putting their lives on the line and the criminals they're dealing with, how did you deal with that aspect of it?
Well, by doing everything in my power and encouraging other supervisors and managers to do everything we could to help protect the health and safety and well-being of our officers, policies and procedures and equipment and training.
Okay. And did you feel that they were getting a fair shake from the media, from the public, and the work they were doing?
Well, on some occasions, the answer would be yes, and on other occasions, the answer would be no. Mm-hmm. The understanding that we have of the nature of police work and the challenges of police work as a society, and that, of course, includes the media, the better off will be not only our police officers, but our citizens.
What is the nature? And for a typical day for a police officer, is it a pleasant experience?
I speak from my 34 years of experience, now much of that, of course, in management leadership positions. But as a cop, you face an incredible variety of challenges in a given shift, which can make for a very rich professional experience, can also tax officers. Moving from, let's say, attempting to console parents who have lost a child to a crib death overnight, to responding in the next moment to a bank robbery, maybe hostages having been taken, to a barroom brawl, to you name it. I mean, police officers are called into situations where folks are oftentimes not having their best days.
So what is the mindset that develops? I mean, when you're basically being called into difficult, traumatic, or dangerous situations, how do officers kind of set their minds for that?
Well, in a healthy way, they're building the kind of psychological hardiness and emotional resilience that's necessary to go from one kind of a situation to the next, particularly when around the next corner could be somebody who wants to do you in. There are many people who have said such things as, the next cop who stops me, I'm going to blow him away. And police officers are well informed about that threat. And being informed, being educated, and developing, putting a lot of experience under your duty belt is a good way of handling one incident, going from one incident to the next with a kind of professionalism and self-confidence that comes of experience and training.
Norm Stamper with us, retired Seattle police chief, his brand new book, To Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police. When you see groups like Black Lives Matter saying that police brutality is a common thing, a major problem, one of our country's biggest problems, do you agree with their perspective?
You know, I do. And if for example, there are 18,000 law enforcement agencies in this country. Some of them are just excellent. Some of them not so much. There are almost 800,000 police officers. Some of them are extraordinarily competent, and the kind of work that they do should make everyone proud. And then there are those officers who seem to feel that, you know, we're the cops and you're not, so just listen to what we've got to say and everything will be just fine. Well, Americans are not taught to simply accept authority, however some people might wish that to be the case. They're all about challenging authority questioning.
When did that happen? I mean, even when you're not in uniform, did you ever in a million years imagine you'd challenge a cop or confront a cop somehow?
No, absolutely not. That's not the way I was brought up. It is, however, the way many people have been raised or many people have come to see the police, however they arrived at that viewpoint. And I think If police officers understand that and they recognize that this country was founded on questioning authority, that they'll learn to not take it personal, which would be the best advice I think give to anybody in that line of work.
Is that being taught in police academies to anticipate that and to roll with it?
Yeah, generally speaking, it is. We're seeing, ever since Ferguson, we're seeing a much greater emphasis on de-escalation skills. Mm-hmm. If you want to survive to go out and work another shift the next day, the more competent and effective you are at de-escalating tension, at handling crises, the more likely that will be the case.
But isn't Ferguson an example of where the media really led us astray and told the wrong story initially, though?
You know, I think that's obviously a matter of perspective. I think when I hear police officers getting very angry that the expression Black Lives Matter seems to have taken such a foothold, and they're saying, well, listen, Blue Lives Matter as well. Mm-hmm. My view is certainly all lives matter. And if we can cultivate respect for the particular interests that a group of citizens have, just respect for it doesn't mean agreement. Mm-hmm. We have a much better chance of getting that group to respect us.
Right, but in Ferguson, the Ferguson story was that he had his hands up, right? Michael Brown had his hands up, and it turns out the facts showed that was not the case, right? That he was actually charging the officer.
Right.
So, I mean, when you see these things come out, because we've seen videos certainly that show clear brutality and the police acting inappropriately, and they're shown repeatedly. What is that doing to the psyche of the country?
Well, I think it's having a major effect, and some of it clearly is negative, some of it is positive. It's focusing attention on use of force policies and procedures and training and who we select to be police officers in the first place, and that's all good. Mm-hmm. It's a terrible injustice to those officers who wouldn't think, for example, to shoot Laquan McDonald in the back, or to shoot Walter Scott, a fleeing African-American man who is running from a white police officer, which adds, obviously, whether we like it or not, a racial dimension to this extremely poor police
work. When you see videos like that, what kind of an officer would do something like that? I mean, where does that come from to shoot a man in the back that way?
It comes from somebody who is oftentimes, believe it or not, afraid. And a fearful officer, I'm talking about fear that's out of hand, that's beyond proportion to threats that are perceived. Clearly, this was one such case. But I think it also comes from the inability of some officers to recognize that when their authority is challenged, they don't have the right to use force or lethal force unless there is a physical, or for that matter, mortal threat to the officer or someone else.
What if that means a suspect running away, though?
What it means when you got a suspect running from you is there is absolutely no justification for that action. And in fact, it is murder committed on the part of somebody in one of our uniforms, which makes it then very difficult for other officers to explain that away.
What should the reaction be if you've got a suspect who's not complying, who may be able to overpower you physically? How should officers be reacting in these situations?
Officers are entitled and, in my judgment, obligated to use that amount of force necessary to overcome resistance. And that does mean that if somebody is fleeing from you, they're not fighting you. They are, by definition, running. Now, both of these cases, McDonald in Chicago, Scott in North Charleston, South Carolina, were charged with murder.
Right.
And I haven't talked to a single police officer who disagrees. I'm sure they're out there. I just haven't talked to any officer.
No, I mean, those are certainly some of the most outrageous cases. And you say it's fear. Fear can overtake an officer's mind. How do you train an officer to overcome that, then?
By experiential training. A mouthful of syllables that really means basically put officers in simulated situations as realistically posed as possible, and on the basis of what they have learned, you know, a body of knowledge and a set of skills. They handle those situations in this simulated situation, and they feel what happens to their bodies under those stressful situations.
Yeah, I guess you can't replicate the fear.
Self-management.
Yeah, the fear of really thinking you're about to die, though. I'm sure you can't really replicate that, though, right?
Well, I gotta tell you something. I used to believe that, and I've talked to pilots and certainly heard and read about commercial airline pilots and fighter pilots in the military who are wringing wet when they step out of a simulator. They know when they go in that they're not going to be at risk of losing a multi-billion dollar aircraft or their lives, or for that matter, taking the lives of anyone. They know it's a simulation, and yet if it's done well, and we have this technology, we have this capability, we can help every police officer in this country understand what it means to be under threat that causes you to believe, even in simulation, that you're not going to survive this.
I should know, one of the things you think you say we need to do to fix America's police is we need to get the communities involved, local communities. How so that they're not involved now?
Well, there are very few police departments in the country, or sheriff's office for that matter, that do not claim to be practicing community policing. For me, the community policing itself is a good starting point for a definition of community involvement. If a community feels ownership for its own neighborhood, preventing problems, solving problems, reducing crime, achieving public safety, all while valuing civil liberties of their fellow citizens.
Yeah.
If they
how do you get a community to do that, though?
Organize, mobilize, educate, agitate, do the kinds of things that Americans have done, you know, for centuries and done well, particularly when the stakes are so high, like the civil rights movement, one example.
When you look at an urban community that's struggling today, how hard is that for them to do what you're just saying right there?
Well, it's very hard if there's little or no respect for or trust in the police. And police can do much to turn that around. Even if there has been no systemic discrimination, no excessive force, no pattern of misconduct, and you have a police department saying, we're going to reach out to our community, we want to invite participation in policymaking and program development and setting priorities for law enforcement in that particular community, and people are treated with dignity and respect, especially under trying circumstances. That's when it becomes most important. You find that that out of that comes a partnership, and a partnership's a 50-50 proposition.
Right, and this is just part of the book, by the way. Another thing, Norm Stamper, retired Seattle police chief, says we need to do is end the war on drugs. We'll have you on to talk some more. Norm Stamper, his brand new book, To Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police. A man who knows very much of what it takes to do that. Norm, great to have you on WILS. Thank you.
My privilege. Thank you.